began to talk about having a focused life in 2017. And if you remember, we went to ask Paul about how he might help us in this task. And in Philippians, Paul challenged us as he challenged himself. If we are going to have a focused life, we have to focus upon Jesus. Paul said that he would give up everything to know Jesus. Now, he wasn't just talking about knowing about Jesus. He was talking about knowing Jesus. Knowing Jesus in a relationship as a personal Savior. As a relationship of one who depends upon another. And Paul said in cultivating that relationship, we would have the power of his resurrection. Not only would we know Jesus, but in knowing him in that way, we would know the power of his resurrection. And what Paul was talking about was the power of God. God in his magnificent power defeated death and raised his son up to live again. And it is that power that Paul wanted to tap into so that his life would have some meaning. Not just days on this old ball of mud, but truly have meaning in that he could spend eternity with the Master. But in that knowing Jesus, Paul said, if we are really serious about knowing him, we need to know the fellowship of his sufferings, is the way he said it. Now, I've often seen the slogan, save to serve, but I have not ever seen one that said, save to suffer. We're not too big on the suffering deal. But Paul said, until we know and share in the fellowship of his sufferings, it's going to be hard to truly know Jesus. Now, Paul could really say that. In fact, he talked about bearing in his body the marks of the suffering for Jesus. And truly he could, because Paul had been beaten many times with whips, and he had been stoned, and he had been shipwrecked, and his life and service to the Lord was marked with many physical challenges and sufferings. I am so thankful to God that we don't have to suffer in that way. I'm so thankful that we don't have to hide our worship for fear of someone coming in to take us into custody and take away our possessions and our children. And it's a great and marvelous blessing that God has bestowed upon us in our 21st century world. So how can we share in the sufferings of Jesus? How can we do that? Well, I told you in that study together that I would try to help us by helping us maybe to see a little clearer the challenges and the sufferings that Jesus made on our behalf as he was tried and crucified and some of the things that he had to go through. And maybe, just maybe, If we can be impressed in our minds, in our hearts, of what my Lord truly did for me, maybe I can come to know a little bit more about my Jesus. So, I want to this morning take us back to Mark 14 and the trial of Jesus. And I want to ask the question eventually this morning, what will you do with Jesus? But first, let's go back and let's see what the Sanhedrin did with Jesus. Now, Mike's class, he's challenged you to this morning to listen for the points. Here's one of them. What did the Sanhedrin do with Jesus? Well, as we go to Mark, we see here that after Jesus was taken in the Garden of Gethsemane and he was led away by the soldiers, they took him to the house of Caiaphas, the high priest. And we read beginning in verse 53, and they led Jesus away to the high priest. And there came together with him the chief priests, the elders and the scribes, and Peter had followed them afar off, even within the court of the high priest. And he was sitting with the officers and warming himself in the light of the fire. Now notice how Mark sets the scene here. The meeting place here is the house of Caiaphas, the high priest. Now, this is called the Sanhedrin. This was like the Supreme Court. This is the big dogs right here. And the Sanhedrin was composed of 70 members. They were the chief priest, the high priest, the teachers of the law, and the scribes. And these 70 men composed this Sanhedrin. Now, Jesus is taken to the Sanhedrin, before the Sanhedrin, and he is going to be judged. He's placed in the midst of them. Just outside is the courtyard. And then just outside of that is the outer courtyard. And there's where we see that Peter has taken his place. But the trial before the high priest had two stages. One is the one where they take the evidence, the witnesses. The other is where they make the judgment. Well, in verse 55, beginning, we read, and the chief priest and all of the council sought testimony against Jesus to put him to death. And already decided what they were going to do. The outcome of this trial, this illegal trial, was to put Jesus to death. They're just trying to find some people that will witness against him that will give them something to based that decision on. For many bore false witness against him, but none of their testimonies agreed. And some rose up and bore false witness against him, saying, we heard him say, I'll destroy the temple that is made with hands, and within 3 days I'll build another one without hands. But even then their testimony didn't agree. This whole trial was a total farce. There are so many illegalities that went on in this trial. Three of the big ones was, first of all, the trial was not to be held at night. This was Jewish law, written down. Trial by the Sanhedrin was not to be at night. Number two, the place. Again, Jewish law stated that a Sanhedrin trial had to take place in a certain place in the temple. This was in Caiaphas' house. A third very glaring illegality was that the Sanhedrin was forbidden by Jewish law to render a verdict on the same day as the trial. Obviously, that's not going to happen. But despite all of these illegalities, the trial still wasn't going very well. They couldn't get anybody to really agree on the false witness. They and I don't know why, because they were the best false witness that money could buy. But it still wasn't going well for the priest. And so finally, Mark says they found these men. Matthew says there were two of them. But Mark in verse 58 says that there were some men that stood up and said, "We heard him say that he would destroy the temple and that he would build it up again in 3 days." Well, here was the first thing that had a little measure of truth to it. Because Jesus actually did say something similar to that. John points out to us in John chapter 2 and verse 19 that whenever Jesus drove the money changers out of the temple, he said, and here's what he said, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." And 2 verses later, John explains to us that Jesus was talking about his body, the temple, his body. And he was really, this is the first mention that Jesus makes of the resurrection, because he was talking about he would die and then he would be raised back up alive again. He didn't say, "I will destroy the temple." He said, "Destroy the temple. You are going to destroy. Destroy the temple and I will raise it back up." So even in that, you know, but at least it had a ring of truth. Tennyson once said, "A lie that is wholly a lie can be met and fought with outright. But a lie that is partially true is a harder matter to fight." And that's what you had here. You had a lie that had a little truth sprinkled in it. So then, even though that, it still wasn't, it wasn't a foundation, it wasn't enough. It wasn't enough to condemn Jesus to death. Now that's what they're wanting to do, but they're kind of wanting to have some basis anyway, you know, to do it. So that brings us to the next point. What did Caiaphas do with Jesus? Caiaphas is, of course, the high priest, and now he steps in to take over this situation. He's desperate right now. So again, he takes a very unusual step, an illegal step, again, by the way, because now he steps down from being in the position of judge to being prosecuting attorney. And so he starts questioning Jesus. It says in verse 60, "And the high priest stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, saying, Answer thou nothing? What is it which these witnesses say against thee? But he held his peace and answered nothing." Oh, that just went all over Caiaphas. But hundreds of years before, Isaiah chapter 53 and verse 7, Isaiah had predicted that Jesus would be as a sheep that is before his shearers is dumb, so he opened not his mouth. Isn't that something? Again, that just shows you that God is involved in this, because here, this statement's made hundreds of years before this actual event is taking place. So Jesus made no attempt to defend himself, didn't answer these false witnesses. So the high priest is stunned by Jesus' silence. So again, why not? Everything about this trial is illegal. So what's one more thing, you know? So Caiaphas does something totally illegal, and he compels Jesus to testify against himself. And he says, again, the high priest asked him and said, "Art thou the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?" Now, this is precisely what the Pharisees had been trying to get Jesus to admit to for months. But Jesus had remained silent because the time just wasn't right. But now he would answer. They had gone through the testimony about breaking the Sabbath day and letting his disciples eat. That didn't get anywhere. They had gone through the testimony about Jesus casting out devils in the name of the devil, and that didn't take any kind of root. So, and they'd even already gone past the temple deal, because that wasn't enough. Even that wasn't enough to put him to death. So Jesus is going to answer the one charge that could lead to a verdict of death. And here's the thing. Jesus knew it. So he answers. He answers him. Caiaphas says, "Are you the Son of God?" And Jesus says, "I am." And then he adds, "And you shall see the Son of Man sitting the right hand of power and coming with the cloud in the clouds of heaven." He was talking about the judgment. What he was saying to Caiaphas was, "You're judge, I'm prisoner now. But the time's coming when I'm going to be the judge, and you're going to be the one that will be judged." So anyway, we read that Caiaphas now says, This is great. He's so happy. He hypocritically acts like that he's outraged. He's really very happy and very relieved. But it says, "And the high priest rent his clothes." He tore his clothes. That's supposed to be a sign of outrage and contriteness. "And what further need have we of witnesses?" he says. "You heard the blaspheming. What do you think?" And they all condemned him to be worthy of death. Now watch this right here. You want to talk about what Jesus was willing to do for us? You listen to this. "And some of them began to spit on him, and to cover his face, and to hit him, and to say to him, 'Prophesy.' And the officers received him with blows of their hands." So being spit on, that's one of the ultimate insults. They spit on him, and then they hit him, and they covered his face up, and they'd hit him and say, "If you're Jesus, if you're really the Son of God, tell us who just hit you." And then they deliver him over to the soldiers for them to have their turn. They beat on him. But again, Isaiah, 750 years before, said, I offer my back to those who beat me, my cheeks to those who pull out my beard. I did not hide my face from mocking and spitting. So this was something that Jesus knew was coming. And you know, you study these things, you read these things, and you think, why did he do that? I mean, Jesus had the power to call down the angels. 10,000 angels, and they would have been there like that and swept him away. And he could have called down fire from heaven and consumed every one of them. Or he could have struck Caiaphas with leprosy. Whatever he wanted to do, the power was his. Whenever Pilate later on is going to say, compel him to answer and say, don't you know I have the power to put you to death? And Jesus would tell him then, you don't have any power. It's not given to you. So you gotta ask yourself sometime, somewhere, I hope it's today. Ask yourself, why did he do that? Why? Why would he let them spit on him? Why would he let them beat him? Why would he let them hang him on a cross and shamefully die a horrible, horrible death? And there just isn't a logical answer. Except, he loved me. He loved me more than I can ever, ever know. He loved me more than I could ever, ever deserve. That's the only answer. And he's asking that I love him back. He's just asking that I love him back. So now, here is the most important question of all. And that is, what will you do with Jesus? We saw what Peter did. Peter denied him. But even in that, we learn that failure is not final. Because Peter later went out whenever he realized what he had done, hearing the Lord's word that you'll deny me three times before the rooster crows twice. It did. And it said that Peter's tears flowed. The Greek terminology there is that he was totally cast down. Peter went out and threw himself prostrate on the ground and wept in his tears. We see the difference. Caiaphas didn't shed any tears. Sanhedrin didn't shed any tears. It's not recorded that Judas shed any tears. He was sorry for what he'd done. But Peter's tears were a penitent sign, and God forgave him, the Master forgave him, and brought him back to prominence, allowed him to stand before those on the day of Pentecost and preach this mighty truth of Jesus. So the question now is, what will you do with Jesus? Saw what the Sanhedrin did. Saw what Caiaphas did. Saw what Peter did. But the real important question is, what will you do with Jesus? I'm prayerful that you'll let him in your life. That you'll let your faith lead you to obedience, to be baptized for the remission of your sins, to walk with him and for him in your life so that you can walk with him in eternity. Will you come while together we stand and sing?
Kneel at the cross, Christ will meet you there. He intercedes for you.